Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for Banal of America
of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
I swear to God, I think that song gets longer every episode. I think there's like magic elves who are doing something there, making that song longer. But anyway, no commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules. And at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. And I can't believe it. I have no idea how we're doing it here 3 weeks in a row. So all those people that were like, Banal, you're going to disappear again. So this is 3 weeks in a row, and we got a whole bunch more coming down the line. And tonight is going to be a really good one, because as you might be able to tell, I'm in jam session mode tonight, folks. I don't really have any notes or anything, because I know I'm going to be on with a real talker and a real thinker, and someone that we can just bounce ideas off of each other. We don't really need a roadmap here, so where we're going, we don't need roads, like that movie says. I'm talking about author, podcaster, thinker, pundit, Micah Hanks, the man behind the Grillion Report, and a whole bunch of other projects we'll talk about tonight. And he's back on BOA Audio for a good old-fashioned Banal of America jam session. Who better than Micah Hanks for a jam session? So welcome back to the show, my friend.
Salutations, Tim Banal. Let's get ready to rumble and rub everybody the wrong way, as we tend to do.
Oh, yeah. There's nothing I like better than rubbing somebody the wrong way. Wait a minute. So I was thinking, we haven't talked. It's been a year, like, since I had you on the show. And So what happened here, Micah? We don't know anything about UFOs yet. We still don't have a Bigfoot. We got no ghosts. We haven't proven anything. We haven't solved anything. What the hell happened, man? I thought we were going to be working on this over the past year.
Well, my first and primary objective had been to get to Los Angeles back in April and hang out with you. I failed miserably and had to scratch that one off the dossier. So looking ahead, onward to bigger and better things, I suppose. And, yeah, it's true because, Tim, there are the ever-present mysteries. I won't say too much about this, but I'll just I'll very, very briefly mentioned that I have spent the majority of the afternoon, the last 4 hours, in fact, monitoring the Joe Rogan podcast because it was one of the most insightful.
Monitoring.
Yeah, because I'm a big fan of Joe.
Yeah, I know. You were listening to it. You were monitoring.
Well, let's describe the difference between listening and monitoring. You know, if you listen, you kick back, you have a beer. I'm drinking decaf tea, so that's the first problem. I'm still drinking decaf green tea in a large mug right here. And I took, let's see here, how many pages of notes did I take? 1, 2, 3 pages of notes. So, yeah, I was actually monitoring.
Wow.
Yep, I was monitoring the podcast. And I won't say, again, too much more, but I want to give props to Joe for putting together what I think was one of the finest conversations and one of the most necessary conversations right now. My good friend Randall Carlson was one of the, I don't know if you'd call it a panel, it was more kind of a roundtable/debate, but Randall was there with Graham Hancock, who I've met and spent a little time with and actually gotten to talk to, and then a fellow I've never met or talked with, but who I'd like to talk with, Michael Shermer, the prominent skeptic. I got to tell you, and this will be all I include on that subject on this podcast, but coming from what I think is a fundamental, yep, but coming from what I call a fundamentally skeptical disposition on things myself, Tim, I was amazed. Don't get me wrong. I respect Michael Shermer among skeptics, especially because he is a more friendly and approachable skeptic. He is not a denialist. He is not a person who ridicules just for the sake of just trying to sound snarky, like I think a lot of skeptics do. And so I really respect that about Shermer and always have. But he came to this discussion, and I think he was, and I'm just speaking fairly, he was woefully unprepared to discuss a lot of the archaeological subjects that came up, and said some very outdated things, primarily about the first arrivals into North America and the idea of the so-called Clovis first hypothesis. This is something I'm deeply interested in and involved with. So again, I'll leave it at that. But what I think the big takeaway from this podcast was that we don't need to look at people who, and I know a lot of people in this community don't look at skeptics and say, well, you know, they're not the first people I go to anywhere, right? I do try to balance my arguments, okay? I do try to listen as much to, for instance, those who would be advocates of the existence of things like UFOs or even the possible existence of something like Bigfoot. I try to balance those types with the skeptics. But seeing Michael Shermer unprepared and misinformed, and I'm not attacking him because really I think he did a great job and I appreciate him, and some of the, there was a lot of value and a lot of merit to a lot of things that he said, but it just goes
no,
to
no, you're not coming at him personally, you're just critiquing his take on things, so you don't need to apologize.
I do, because I don't want someone to hear that and take it the wrong way and be like, oh, he's just, you know, being another naysayer. No, I actually do respect Michael Shermer, but I feel that I was, and just go on my Twitter, at Micah Hanks, follow me on Twitter, folks, and you'll see everything I had to say about Michael Shermer right there. There were a lot of problems. And these aren't my opinions. These are factual errancies, okay? So, again, what we learn is we need to question what skeptics have to say about these things just as much as we question those who present alternative theories like Graham Hancock. Now, again, as far as not having any answers about Bigfoot, UFOs, things like that, coming back to your fundamental talking point there, we really don't have a lot, you know? I mean, how many more books can we write, speculative folk tales, basically, legends and stories about things that people say that they've seen without a whole lot more tangible evidence that we can move forward on? I'm sorry, again, if that rubs somebody the wrong way. We were getting tweets about this prior to the podcast, you know, but hey, sometimes we do have to ask those hard questions, don't we? Both of the skeptics and of the making the extraordinary claims.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know what the hell that guy was talking about. So I don't know what – I don't. You said something like that he felt like he was undersold or something like that, where it sounded like – are you selling, like, penis enhancer pills or something on your show? It was something weird, like he was like, I didn't get my money's worth or something. He was like, what are you talking about, dude? It's a podcast.
Well, you know, I like to have a little fun with – you know, there's a part of me, of course, that worries when people say that, you know, I'm not going to tune into Tim Banal's podcast tonight because Micah Hanks is going to be on there. And I want to think to myself, well, how can I better reach people? You know, how can I present information or articulate what I'm saying in a way that doesn't make people feel burned or disenfranchised for whatever reason? I'm not sure what would have caused that. But there's also that side where you have to say that if you're not stirring the pot and making a few people uncomfortable, then you aren't doing your job as a researcher and a presenter of information. I think that we have to challenge ideas and arguments, and that's really what we're here to do, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, well, you're right about having to keep an eye on these skeptics, because I mentioned it to you off the air a while back, and I brought it up with Stan. There was this idiot skeptic back when everyone was talking about fake news. This idiot skeptic was like, it all began with the UFO newsletter APRO. They're the ones who first started printing fake news. And it was like, what the fuck are you talking about? What are you, crazy? Like, where, you're just pulling it out of your ass. And it was like in a relatively mainstream publication where it was like, they should be ashamed of themselves for even running this stupidity. But they did. So, but we won't even.
They're just... Yeah, we won't, but I will just add to this that I know the skeptic you're talking about. I have had some meaningful dialogue over the years and some very nice private email exchanges, lengthy ones with that skeptic. I know you've spoken with that skeptic at length also. And, you know, again, the problem was that was a fairly biased interpretation of the so-called history of fake news that was incorrect, factually incorrect. The primary claim being that, of course, fake news really kind of began back in the 50s and 60s with UFO groups, when in truth, as you if you look back through history, fake news, newspaper hoaxes, these sorts of things, they have been a part of American culture since the founding of this country. And newsflash, the idea of fake news or bad information being seeing wide circulation goes far back, much further back, I should say, than just the United States. I mean, this is not a new phenomena that we are seeing here. So the skeptic in question, who out of respect also I won't name, but I will say, although I understand that they were trying to say essentially the same thing, it's a much older phenomena, they really misattributed it, and that was factually incorrect. So I think that, again, while the intention was good, the facts weren't there. The true fact is that fake news is something that I think we're seeing differently today, and a lot of that has to do, Banal, with the way that media is obtained by people, how people get their news and where they read it, the World Wide Web, and of course, you know, what gets the most clicks, you know, this clickbait
right.
phenomena. So,
right.
you know, we could say plenty about that, but again, when we talk about being good skeptics, we do need to question everything. When you hear factual inaccuracies being made by skeptics, you're not wrong to say, well, actually, hold on, guy, slow down. Let's back up a little bit. Let's talk about this. That's exactly what we need to be doing, is having these conversations and really getting to the bottom of the fact versus these so-called fake news, because sometimes reporting on the fake news can be fake in itself, to an extent.
Right, right. Well, that's the thing, too. I feel like you and I, at least, we try. We come at this from an honest perspective, you know, with our hands out, like being like, hey, man, I'm not armed. And it's like, this person, I don't want to belabor this angle, this APRO thing too long, but it was like, this. Plenty of people I know raised hell about the stupidity of this statement, including myself when I interviewed Stan. And it's like, if you want to sell yourself as a genuine little-ass skeptic and someone who genuinely wants to get to the bottom of this, then you have to have the chutzpah, you have to have the testicular fortitude or whatever it is there, the guts to say, hey, man, I blew it. I fucked up. I'm mistaken in what I was trying to say this. But to just ignore it and say, oh, these UFO nerds, you know, that kind of shit. It's like, you're not playing with a full deck. You're not playing with a fair deck either. You know, it's like, give me a break. You know, I'm one of the first guys, like when that Chilean UFO story came out in January, I was like, holy shit, this is awesome. This is like a great UFO story, and finally, like, some government's going to get to the bottom of this. And then it fell apart, like, in 3 days, and I was, like, one of the first people then to say, oh, shit, it fell apart, you know? It's like, I'm willing to fall on the sword when the facts don't hold up. I'm not out there just selling a biased bill of goods, and I think that's what some of these skeptics do, you know?
Well, yeah, and in fairness, too, you know, there are also the good skeptics, and then there are some people in the research community that study UFOs and things like that that are equally willing to sell biases, false information, hoaxes, and bullshit. And see, that's, again, something
exactly.
I love about you. You've always – you have always truly, as long as I've known you, and let me just say this. I've known you for years. I think the second interview I ever did by phone ever had been on your show. And as long as I've known you, yes, Benal, you've been a very – honest person. Even if you call me and we're not on the air, I mean, you're like, Mike, I want your real opinion on something. You know, I've always respected the way you come at things, because you really do try to call bullshit when necessary, whether or not it is a popular opinion that you assert.
No, thanks, man. I appreciate that. I try to be as honest as I can on the show, you know? And if I have to fib or sort of sit back while someone else is fibbing, I try to make it pretty, you know, pretty obvious that what I'm hearing I find dubious without being a dick about it, you know, because there are some shows where people will be like, they want to call somebody out for something. It's like, I don't need to do that, you know. This person's giving me their time. We're trying to have a conversation. So it's like, if I don't really believe what they say, it's like, you know, I kind of having some trouble with this, you know. So I prefer, you catch more flies with honey than you do with vinegar.
Yeah, exactly. That's true. You know, Abraham Lincoln, for instance, he was he once discussing temperance. He was essentially making the statement that if you're going to bring someone to your argument, and I persuade someone, for instance, not to drink, he said, we don't bring people to our argument by attacking and ridiculing them. We must first make them think that they are our best friends. And then we can bring them to our argument. And so I got to be honest. I mean, when I was in my earlier you know, years becoming a researcher, and I, you know, maybe in my early 20s, I went through a really argumentative streak there, a period where I would get into it with, I did work in talk radio, so I would get into it with my fellow hosts. I would get into it with my girlfriend at the time. I would get into it with my family. Yeah, we would argue a lot, and I began to realize that I was becoming let's give this a proper term. I was trying to become a master debater. Okay, I thought that I had to debate everything with everybody, and really all it was just argument for the sake of argument alone. It was me being contrarian, and I got to a point where I began to realize, you know, this is not constructive, and I kind of unwound myself and came down off of that. And over several years, I've really become I think, better at having a discussion with people. And I'll have people try to debate sometimes, and I will consistently try to steer it away from a debate and try and find common ground with people, to which debaters will often say, what are you doing? Why don't you argue your point instead of talking about what I'm discussing? And I'm saying, well, I may actually agree with you. Let's not presume that we disagree on all points. Let's actually find where we have common ground and then build our way out from that, which will often throw people for a loop. And I think that in a lot of ways, you know, we have to kind of approach all these sorts of subjects in the same way, whether you're talking about politics or, you know, science and skepticism versus the unexplained. Let's understand that we actually do probably have more common ground than at the outset many of us would agree to admit. And understanding that common ground, for instance, let's talk about UFOs for a minute, Benal.
Sure.
With the UFO argument, we hear people say, well, you know, 90% of UFO, actually, they'll usually say 99% of all UFOs can be explained by natural phenomena. Now, I agree. And then someone will say Venus or, you know, refraction of light off of it. But see, that's where I start saying, okay, now, it's one thing to say that there are perhaps natural phenomena that could explain a variety of UFOs, and perhaps the majority as well. I don't know if it's necessarily 90%, but then again, I mean, those figures are rough at best. There are no exact numbers in terms of, because again, those actual anomalous UFOs, or at very least the ones that remain unexplainable, i.e. unidentified flying objects, those kinds of things, you know, we don't really know how many varieties of phenomena observed would constitute actual UFOs versus those which would not. And therefore, you know, to try and say 90% of all this can be explained, you know, I do think that the majority sure can be explained, and that, yeah, probably natural phenomena and certain misidentifications of other kinds of things, both man-made and natural, do account for, yes, the majority of UFOs. I'm sure Stanton Friedman would agree, and I know he does because I've discussed this with him many times, as you have too. But the thing I think that we miss is that people say that if we can explain UFOs as being something other than alien spaceships, we must assert always that there are prosaic explanations for these phenomena. Somebody sees Venus or Jupiter or something in the sky, and they think this UFO, it's bright, it's brighter than other stars. It doesn't really twinkle like stars. It's in the same place every night. We watch it come up over the horizon. So whatever this thing is, it just sits there and hovers. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you're probably looking at a planet. But is that really the best explanation for all UFOs, especially those which seem to possess characteristics that are very atypical of these kinds of astronomical phenomena? When someone describes seeing a very large triangle-shaped object moving very slowly, you know, I think about that St. Clair County UFO incident from back in 2000, where all the police officers in parts of southern Illinois observed this thing. Again, Brian Dunning, a popular skeptic, says this was one of the American Airship Company's blimps, and that this is easily debunked because nobody thought to contact them. He said, I did. They said, yeah, it was probably one of our blimps giving a VIP tour. They never give any records of the flight of any blimp. They never show any evidence, a shred, that would account for the object that was purportedly seen, or why every police officer who saw it, except for one of them who observed it at too great a distance to discern anything more than a light, they don't offer any explanation for why every officer described a distinctly triangle-shaped object, slow-moving, except for at certain times when it would suddenly very quickly pick up speed and cover a large stretch of space in a very short amount of time. A very anomalous characteristics of an aircraft, especially of that size. Every police officer that saw this, except for one, described it as being triangular in shape. There's no information about who the VIP tour was given to, why the VIP tour took place at 4 o'clock in the morning, the most logical time of all to give a VIP tour, right?
Oh, of course.
I mean, again, a highly speculative and, frankly, extremely credulous scenario given as explanation with no actual facts to support it, apart from the fact that Brian Dunning claims he contacted the American Airship Company and they said, yeah, it could have been one of ours. Case closed? I don't think so. In fact, that explanation does not match the witness testimony. And if we cannot trust our officers of law spread out across several different municipalities, you know, all observing the same object over the course of a couple of hours on the same evening in question, some of them at close range and one who actually even photographed the thing, granted it wasn't a good photo, but I mean, if we cannot trust our officers of law and look at this and say, maybe they really did see what they said that they saw, if we have to come up with a cockamamie excuse for why what they saw looked completely different from what it supposedly actually was, which shouldn't have been there at that time and place to begin with, you know, if we can do no better than that, I'm skeptical of your skepticism.
Right, right. Well, that's the thing here, too. That's the – these folks, they can't say, I don't know. it's like not in their DNA or something. It's like you present them with a crazy case and they have to come up with, like, they will go to the ends of the earth to come up with some stupid fucking excuse for what it is instead of going, I don't know, you know? So that's, to me, that's the real, and listen, there are people in ufology who are worse or just as bad, who are like, it's a fucking alien spaceship and they're coming here because, you know, da-da-da-da-da, and they invent these fantastic scenarios for something that we, at the bottom line, we don't know. It's just something weird that was in the sky. It's like, that's what the U in UFO stands for, man. It's an unidentified flying object. It's like, people need to disassociate that from, just keep it as a, it's just a question mark, man. It's a blank space. It's not, that's, I think, the problem, you know? And people fill this blank space with all this, with their own fucking baggage. You know,
well,
that's what it is.
We could ask this question. Yes, it is. I agree with you. And I think, Benal, you know, we could ask the question, well, if the majority of UFOs are either not alien spacecraft, but probably not blimps, and both the skeptics and the UFO believers are largely, you know, kind of catering to their preconceptions and pushing less than likely scenarios for what some good UFO reports are, is there really anything worth studying? You know, I do have friends who tell me, you know, man, come on, Mike, are you ever going to get away from all that stuff? The question that I have about UFOs would be, well, is there something of scientific merit to the study of UFOs? And I find, you know, again, my UFO people think that there's nothing in the world to see or to understand or to explain or study but UFOs. My people who are less inclined to be interested in UFOs are like, everything but UFOs should be interesting. My question is simply this. In the broader consensus opinion, or perhaps you could say alternative, realm of science, I mean, is there something that we can learn from the study of UFOs as it relates to these large aircraft that, in truth, my gut tells me, and that is a speculative position I take, but nonetheless, I maintain I think that it's probably a logical one. My gut tells me probably we're looking at some varieties of government aircraft and that there are echelons of government levels of secrecy, agencies and divisions and things that, you know, typically are kept well off the books as a result of black budget programs and the like. I mean, I think that there's a very good case to be made throughout history without looking at even the more anomalous UFO cases. We can look at just fairly typical aircraft for the time and documentation that is clearly shown as a result of mention of aircraft but redaction of the names of those aircraft, that there are aircraft that have been employed for missions, especially over the Pacific Ocean. We saw a report from 2015 that did exactly this. It named three aircraft. One was redacted, so presumably we don't know the name of a particular aircraft that was explicitly stated in the documents released, had been engaged in spy missions over the Pacific. So we do know that there is a good case to be made, and there is some good information and data that supports the fact that these aircraft are in existence. Now, are they something highly anomalous like the large triangles, or perhaps disc-shaped craft or something else like that? I mean, should we really leap to the conclusion, perhaps, that these so-called large triangles are necessarily something anomalous at all, or are they merely utilizing a technology or varieties of technology that appear less than typical to the, especially the untrained observer, but also to some people with a background in aerospace and aviation? You know, the skeptic asked the question, how could that many people keep something secret like that? That is a big question that we have to try and overcome if we're to really look at the veracity of UFO reports. I mean, if government is behind some of this, how is a secret that well kept?
Well,
I do think, though, that
that's, you actually raised, let me jump in here, Micah, because you raised a really good point that you sort of touched a nerve there, because when you look at it from that perspective, it actually makes the whole idea of, like, how can they keep this a big secret work in a way, because it's like, let's say we're talking about the 90% we can explain, right, and the 10 are unexplainable, the 10%, sort of just going off that basic idea. Let's say 7 or 8% of those are government craft, right, that are secret craft. Like, there's no – if you were holding on to the alien secret and you were in the government, it's like that's a really tantalizing thing to know. I mean, that's life-changing. That's world-changing. But if you're, like, working on the XB-32 – which is like a triangular blimp thing that's stealth, it's like, yeah, it's not that. It's easy to keep that secret, you know? It's just a fucking airplane. So to me, it's like, how do they keep it a secret? Well, a big percent of these are secret craft, and they're like, that's a point of pride if you're working on a secret craft that you don't want people to know about it and stuff. So I think that kind of answers a logical sort of question where it's like they don't have to keep that much of a secret. They only have to keep secret whatever the 2% are that are the really unexplainable ones if they know anything about it.
That's a good point. And also I'll point this out to you. If we're talking about secret clearances and people who under oath have within their position in government obligated themselves to secrecy. They have sworn that they will not reveal state secrets and that they will maintain secrecy based on their clearance in relation to the projects they have worked on. You know, I've known a few people over the years who've worked in military, who've been in Air Force, Army, all different kinds of things. I've known plenty of people and currently know people who have secret clearance or higher clearances, and they never have ever at any time revealed to me information that they were not supposed to reveal. And told me, listen, you know, you're not supposed to know this, but I can tell you, I've never once ever had somebody reveal information to me that they stated I was not supposed to know and that they clearly had a clearance which gave them access to said information. Now, I mean, that's just me. But the point I'm making here is that when people work in government and they know, hey, listen, if I actually tell these secrets, not only could I be held accountable, not only could I be putting American lives in danger, not only could I be imprisoned, not only could this really uproot a lot of hard work that our government has done over the years. When somebody is facing all those burdens just to get a secret off their chest, people say, why aren't there these, you know, deathbed confessions and things? We would have had that happen by now if there were really that many secrets being kept. I'm pretty convinced that when people, and maybe there's a sociological and a psychological element to this also, you know, the master and the commander kind of a thing. But I believe that when people generally go and they take service, you know, in government, and they believe in the cause that they are fighting for and working for, and they swear themselves to secrecy, I believe that, yes, in the majority of instances, people really do keep those kind of secrets. Does that mean that our government has all the secrets about UFOs and they know about aliens and, you know, Eisenhower met with them and all this stuff? Probably not, in my opinion. That's just my opinion. Now, nonetheless, does it mean that there probably are secrets that have been kept from the public? I absolutely believe that. I don't know what they are, though. And that's what I'm trying to differentiate between. I believe there probably are secrets and good reasons why they're kept by people who have sworn under oath in our government by virtue of their jobs and by virtue of their belief in this nation, et cetera, that, yeah, they will keep those secrets. But I don't know what those secrets are. And I think that really that's where the speculation about what's behind the veil of secrecy, it really gets out of hand. But somewhere in the midst of all that, there is, I think, a valid case to be made for a UFO phenomena, which is constituted by a variety of different things. And for a skeptic to say that, look, we all know that there's nothing to UFOs, not so fast, not so sure.
Right, right.
There may be
right.
a lot more to it than you've considered.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. To me, it's like that old expression, but like reverse it in a sense, where it's like there's something there. I don't know what it is, but there's something there to it, you know? There's something to it that what's driven me all these years is trying to figure out what it is, you know? So, but the endless struggle is fought with the people who say there's no there. And it's like, what are you talking about? But it's frustrating in a way, you know, because I'm getting kind of like retrospective here in a lot of ways, because this is our 10th season. We're wrapping up the seasonal format, sort of a big celebratory thing here, and it's like, oh, I've been doing this for like 12 years. It's pretty crazy, and there's a real kind of like a mix of sort of wistfulness and also frustration in a sense where it's like, shit, man, I've been doing this for 12 years, and like I joke with you when we started the show that we don't have any answers to these things, but like I've been thinking about that in the broader perspective where it's like, this really is like, it's a long haul, man. This is a long haul, and it can get pretty frustrating at times because it's like nothing moves fast in the paranormal, man. Nothing moves fast, it seems. It's a very, very sort of like, it requires a lot of patience if you're gonna keep your sanity in this field, because otherwise you can get really bitter or really insane.
Well, see, that's why a lot of people who came into this looking at it and were very interested in UFOs later end up becoming very skeptical. Kevin Randall's a good example of that. You know, on that Joe Rogan podcast today, Graham Hancock, on a couple of occasions when confronted with differences between what he wrote, for instance, in books a decade ago and books that he's written within the last few years, he says, my thought is allowed to evolve. If I'm confronted with evidence that contradicts something I once believed, then that's fine. And And it's hilarious how the skeptics continued to attempt to hold him to things he had said previously and has since renounced. Now, see, I've done the same thing. I've done the exact same thing.
About things.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think when I came into looking at UFOs from the outset, I mean, I initially probably thought, man, maybe there is some evidence that, you know, there are interplanetary visitors and otherworldly things happening. And I don't rule out that possibility. It's just that after, like you say, after spending, you know, a good, you know, I've spent well over a decade doing it. I've been podcasting as long as you, by the way, and congratulations on that. But as far as research goes, my man, I mean, you know, I've definitely been in it about as long as you. Longer, I mean, in terms of my interest, but really getting involved with the research side of it, yeah, at least as long as you've been podcasting. And I'm right there with you. I mean, I know precisely what you're talking about, and I'm sure I feel that way because of exactly what you intimate about that. You know, nothing moves very quickly. And you might say the same of science anyway, but that is also the reason why, because when we can apply our logical deductions to more tangible things, and we do begin to see some results, that is, I think, one reason why I have steadily over the last few years been moving more towards science. I've taken extreme interest in archaeology. I've taken extreme interest in, for instance, Paleo-Indian cultures here in America. I've taken extreme interest in physics. I've taken a lot of interest in astronomy, and I've begun to try and understand natural phenomena that can perhaps with some keen observation and maybe even a few clever insights, we might hope to be able to explain some of these things. A few examples, natural luminous phenomena in nature. On numerous instances, I've stood out in the night and observed the sky and seen, well, when I say numerous, I say probably at least three occasions. I've observed what appear to be these little bright flashes of light, pinpoints that appear and then disappear. On one of those occasions, it was fascinating because when I saw it, I looked in the exact area to try and clarify what I was observing. And by that time, of course, it was gone. And lo and behold, it does it again. Bam. And so I look into the scientific literature and find that from the 1980s, there was a paper written about what they called naked eye astronomers, i.e. people who are observing without telescopes, who described seeing what they called these optical flashes or optical bursters. And although there's very little in the way of scientific information about what these people might be seeing, a more recent study, which has appeared recently, discusses how satellite imagery trained back toward Earth has observed strange flashes that occur at times. And I wonder sometimes, now they were saying that it could have been anything from, you know, lights reflecting off of lakes and natural bodies of water on Earth as interpreted by the lens of the cameras oriented on the satellites which are observing. They suppose a number of different things might actually account for this. Carl Sagan had even described strange flashes of light that satellite imagery tended to show from time to time. So, you know, the reason I'm interested, obviously, is because these luminous phenomena, some of them, might indeed account for a few UFO reports. And lo and behold, we also might learn some things about non-UFO related things by studying this sort of stuff. So, you know, I think I've gravitated more toward general interest in science and, you know, so-called anomalies within science, not just geophysics and luminous phenomena that might be, I don't know, related to meteorological phenomena or whatever else might, you know, indicate that they appear in the sky and thus might be natural phenomena of some sort. But I mean, I'm also interested, again, like I said, in archaeology, history, these kinds of things. There are a lot of mysteries worth studying that maybe will bear more fruit when studied, that perhaps UFOs and some of what I call the paranormal pornography, you know, the hardcore paranormal stuff, are Mothman, Bigfoot, UFOs, ghosts, goblins,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
This kind of stuff. I'm not saying those things shouldn't be studied. I'm just saying that, like you have already stated, I mean, how many more stories can we tell without physical evidence? That doesn't mean it's not out there, but it should at very least indicate that perhaps our so-called researchers aren't really doing so-called research at all. Maybe we really need to get people out there who have a little more scientific mind for things and really try and involve themselves in good field work that's not just going to tell us more Bigfoot stories. You know, let's find evidence that substantiates stories, or let's close the book on it if we don't find said evidence.
Part of the problem for us, I think, too, though, is like we've been in this so long that we've heard it all, we've seen it all, we've kind of like, there's no, there's very few like stories, old stories we haven't heard that, we, you know what I'm saying, that we haven't heard. There's like, there's nothing new under the sun in a lot of ways for us. So you have to search out the stuff that's like new because it's you know, I've wrung the Bigfoot rag dry pretty much, you know, as far as trying to get to the bottom of what the hell's going on with that. You know, I've heard it all pretty much. So,
Oh yeah. Yeah. And it seems that again, what you'll tend to see is this is, I think, a phenomenon that's mirrored in UFO lore as well. Back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, the world was rife with crazy reports of UFOs. And on into the 1970s, we had landings, we had humanoids, we had some of the best UFO encounters of all time. Socorro, you know, Pascagoula incident from 1973, things like that. Had all these, I mean, these really good UFO cases. And nowadays, we don't have as much. I mean, it's almost like all the really good UFO reports went away. We had back in the 1950s and 60s, police officers coming forward and saying, look, I saw Bigfoot. We had stories coming out like that of Albert Osman claiming to have been kidnapped by a family of Sasquatches. You know, what apart from what we see that's fairly sensational on shows like Finding Bigfoot, do we hear comparable to that today? Are there aspects of our culture that are changing? And does this in some way account for why we see less strange phenomena? Now, some people would say, but we actually see more. Look at the statistics on UFOs. The sightings are on the rise. Well, no. But there are more sightings appearing on the World Wide Web. And again, the ways that people access information, just like we said about fake news, the ways people get their news and the way that they access information on these subjects has changed over the last decade or two with the proliferation of the World Wide Web. This is technologically really marking a huge change. For me, I remain hopeful, like, you know, about subjects like cryptozoology. Banal, there's the story of, for instance, back in 1983. Something really strange that happened to Gambia. And these kinds of stories, again, it's not a Bigfoot incident that happened right here in the United States. And so you don't hear as much about these kind of stories. But in Gambia back in June of 1983, just a couple of months after I was born, in fact, you know, we had this story of a carcass of something, a dead animal washed on a Gambian beach. And there was a 15-year-old kid named Owen Burnham. He and his family had really been naturalists. Owen was raised up around naturalists, and he himself, I guess, although amateur at the time, had been quite the enthusiast. He knew all the different animal species, had a lot of time in the field, and he drew some really good sketches of this creature, which affectionately became known as Gambo. And what he drew looked like, I guess you might say, it was sort of like a cross between an alligator and a dolphin. He said... he, in fact, said local villagers in this portion of Gambia had actually called the thing a dolphin. But he, of course, knew what dolphins looked like and said this thing was not a dolphin. It seemed to have like a long, pointed kind of a tail. He likened the mouth rather than being, I guess, like an alligator or something. He did liken it to being more like a beak, kind of like a dolphin. The color didn't seem to be right. He said it had a white underbelly and a darker kind of a brownish top. And he said that the remains, when he discovered them, were not particularly decomposed. They were not badly decomposed. This carcass, he said, was remarkably well-preserved at the time that he found it, probably because the creature hadn't been dead for very long. And as the story goes, they say that the villagers took the thing and they actually cut the head off of this creature. The body was buried, and that the head was apparently sold to a tourist, is what they said, back in the 80s that came through the area. This tourist, I'd love to know, if indeed this really happened, if a tourist or someone has in their collection somewhere some extremely anomalous evidence of a mystery species out there. And see, the problem with this is that it's 1983. I mean, there were cameras. Nobody photographed this thing. The kid, being 15 years old, he said he looked at it. He drew sketches of it. And he says that he feels that the sketches are very accurate, and he was comfortable in saying this was not a known species. But the skeptics say, well, you know, there aren't any photographs. It's unlikely this thing ever really existed at all. This is probably just a hoax story.
Right.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
You know, and I know that we always have to say if there's going to be a good case to be made for some sea monster, we do need good evidence. And obviously this case doesn't give us good evidence. But, you know, Carl Shuker and other cryptozoologists, of course, have, involved themselves in this. And they've claimed to have discussed this over the years with Owen, who, again, 15 at the time, nonetheless, was pretty up to speed on what varieties of animals existed, aquatic and otherwise, in that region at that time. Shuker has continued to be in touch with Burnham over the years, and he says he's extremely knowledgeable. His descriptions and the narrative have always remained the same, and he remains adamant that he couldn't identify the animal that they found that time. So frustrating, though, those near-miss kind of stories. We could have had it, and we lost it. What are we talking about here? You know, Shuker said he thought it resembled some sort of an extinct plesiosaur-like animal. I think it was a pliosaur. I believe is the variety, which essentially would have been it didn't have a long neck or anything like that. It didn't look like a typical long-necked plesiosaur. It had, again, it would have more closely resembled a cross between kind of a dolphin and an alligator in shape. So what we're talking about, I mean, I remain hopeful that maybe there are going to be some mysteries like that that will be solved with time. And so, you know, I always remain hopeful, even with Bigfoot. I really do. But it's frustrating when, like you say, you know, you've really just talked this thing to death years now, and it's like, and what more do we have to show for it than just stories?
Yeah, yeah. It's crazy. It's really that's the frustrating part. It's funny, though. It's like you were saying about this I hate ripping on skeptics, but I also love it because I hate them. So. So, but, yeah, it's like I guess I must just be more less cynical, I guess, in that sense, because it's like than the skeptics, I mean, because it's I mean, you always have to allow for the possibility that somebody's making up their story. But then it's like I find it hard to believe that some 15-year-old kid in Gambia in 1983 is going to make up some story about a little creature that washed up on shore. Like it doesn't make any sense. That's less believable to me than a creature washing ashore. It's like why would this kid make up this story?
It may not be unbelievable that a kid would make up a story, but what I do find problematic is that the general tendency among modern skeptics is to disbelieve somebody if they don't produce any evidence. Is it okay to say, well, that's an interesting story, but, you know, we can't really prove anything without better evidence? I mean, a picture, a drawing that you've given us doesn't prove anything. I mean, I concede that. I completely
Absolutely,
agree.
Yeah.
But to go so far as to say that, well, you know, again, it's the speculation that skeptics will do about the motives. This kid was obviously just trying to get attention. He wanted to be famous. Think of all the ways that one might become well known for something, apart from making up a cockamamie story, a story of some sort about some, you know, creature that doesn't fit, you know, any kind of category easily. That just, again, there are better ways that you might be able to find fame and fortune rather than to make up. I'm sure the kid never made a dime off of this story.
Exactly.
The whole point, you know? It's like,
he's a footnote in cryptozoological history. It's not like you, I guess, if you want to hang your hat on that as a life accomplishment, but it's like, I guess maybe if you're 15, that sounds awesome, but it's like, nah, come on, dude.
I'll tell you, though, there are some interesting Bigfoot stories that I've, you know, looked into over the last few years.
Did you hear the recent one about the lady who got in the car accident? You must have heard about
that.
Yes. Big news, yeah.
Yeah, she claimed that she saw a creature chase a deer out into the road, and she ended up crashing her car because she was distracted by what she saw. And, again, you might look at that one of two ways. I mean, she made up a ridiculous story to try and account for why she wrecked her automobile, and might have been able to use the wreck of her automobile as a way to also get attention and to, win some sort of or achieve some sort of a notoriety or you know, get some sort of financial benefit out of it. I don't know. I mean, you could look at it like that, but you could also look at it like, this is such a crazy story, and if you're going to give a plausible scenario for why you wrecked a vehicle, why of all things are you going to say that there was a Bigfoot involved? I mean, you know,
right?
Again, I try to see things, you know, from both perspectives. I had a weird thing happen. I was at a UFO conference in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, about 3 years ago. And this couple who I had known, Dick and Marilyn Carlson, came up and they said, you know, Micah, we have a gift we wanted to give you. And they produce a box and they open the box. And within the box is a large, very real looking, I guess you'd say, casting of a footprint. And it's pretty obvious what this is. And they say, you know, we've not only got the footprint, we've got the forensic sketch of the face of the thing. This was seen by a man named Ken Storch. Now, Ken is actually pretty well known in the community. He had been a former police officer himself, but of course had really, I think, started things as far as his ufological interests with investigations of the Cash Landrum UFO incident. Another one of these famous incidents that causes me to go, you know, why would people go to such lengths to lie about something they claim that they saw? Speaking of the witnesses in that instance. Ken Storch, the story goes that he had been in Pennsylvania with Dick and Marilyn, and that he walked down into this kind of this valley and encountered what he described as being a juvenile. He said, I mean, the thing really looked human. He said it was covered in hair. It had kind of, you know, brownish skin. It had a scar over I think it was the left eye. He said, I could very clearly even see what looked like little bits of crayfish shell in the beard on the thing. And he says, I mean, I see it, I encounter it in the woods, it's about 15 feet away from me, and it, as quick as I see it, it's gone, and it takes off into a stream, he says, into a river there, in Pennsylvania. He says it took off into the stream and just booked it. It was gone as quick as I could say, wow. And he says, I thought it was fascinating that the thing took off and escaped via the river and hence leaving very few prints, and it didn't have a discernible scent that it would leave on the ground. He said this thing obviously to me knew how to get out of there and not be followed. And while carrying this small white-tailed deer. Now, for most people, this would sound like an extremely incredible story, and they would say, this is utter trash. Well, of course, they had the footprint, the casting. Now, you know, if I put my foot over that casting, the foot is, first of all, it appears to be a double impression. You can clearly and very distinctly see two separate heel imprints at the base, which may give the mistaken impression that the foot is actually longer than it is. Secondary to that, which it appears to be the left foot, with the inward toe or the big toe oriented on the right side, if you follow me. There yep. also appears to be a less distinct impression on just adjacent to the left of what would be the ball of the foot, which appears as though it could either be some sort of debris or something upon the ground area where the thing stepped, which there's plenty of that visible in this track, or it could also have been further evidence of this double impression, and these might be the pinky and the adjacent toes on that portion of the foot, which were left as a secondary imprint, where the foot appears to have slid or lifted slightly and came back down. But either way, it's a very unusual print in that there are obviously what look like two prints, but there's one that is far more distinct than the other. So it's still a very good print with lots of discernible details, especially that big toe. No greater distance between the big toe and the smaller digits than a typical human foot. In all ways, you know, morphologically, this resembles a human foot. And being a size 12, myself, well, 11 and a half, if we really want to, you know, be specific, I could put my bare foot over this casting, and it very closely resembles to me the size of my foot. Now, Ken had said that he believed this thing was a juvenile. He says it wasn't maybe more than maybe 6 or 6.5 feet, probably at most, in height. But what's interesting is, again, one question I think that we have to ask, he says this thing definitely looked human, but I mean, there was a lot more hair. But at what point do we say, I mean, something is so distinctly similar to being human that we might say that this thing is essentially human? I mean, the only real defining characteristic that seems to differentiate Bigfoot from you or I is, well, there are two things typically. There does appear to be more hair on the body, and generally these things are larger, according to reports. I have had to at times ask myself, I mean, could we be looking at something a little different? Could we be looking at, in some way, shape, or form, something that is essentially human? In which case we can apply some skepticism to the idea of this mythical monster ape-like creature. What if we're looking at something that's a lot more like a human? So I think in some ways, and this is speculative, I'm looking at this as more of a like a thought experiment. I'm not trying to make an argument for the existence of Bigfoot. I don't know what Ken Stort saw. I didn't take him to be a liar. It's an interesting story, and I kind of leave it right there. And I did speak with him thereafter. I actually have a recording of a conversation he and I had where he gave me the details, which matched perfectly what Dick and Marilyn had told me beforehand. And so I have in my possession this alleged footprint of this thing. We can interpret this one of two ways. You know, maybe somebody left that footprint there. Maybe Ken, you know, found it. Maybe Ken did see what he saw. Maybe he didn't. I don't know. Again, I don't take him to be a liar, and I'm not going to say that just because, well, I don't think I can believe in something like Bigfoot. But I do definitely ask the question, is this mystery what it has long been supposed to be? This mythical ape-man thing, is that really blowing this out of proportion? Can we, you know, is there another way we could interpret what people claim that they see and still account for the multitude of reports of these creatures? You know, I don't know. I don't have those answers. And so unlike a lot of skeptics, rather than saying you are a liar, you know, Ken Storch had to have made up this story. You know, I'm not going to be like that. You know, I all I can tell you is, hey, you know, this is a mystery. We don't have the answers. I've talked with Ken, and he seemed to tell, yeah, a very credible story. And he, you know, I have the footprint right there that the guy says that this is the footprint that was left. We made a casting. He had the forensic artist he knew from his days in the police force, you know, who helped him draw this thing to the best of his ability. And he says, this is a very good representation of what it looked like when I saw it. I mean, that's all we know, but there are plenty of other stories like that. Maybe the scientific community should say, look, is there a different angle we can take? Can we examine this in a new way that we've not thought of that might help us understand what we're dealing with here?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was emboldened by the, or enthused, or whatever the word would be, optimistic about, I don't know if you heard about their, they're doing a thylacine, a Tasmanian tiger scientific expedition in Australia, and they're going to, like, set up a whole bunch of game cameras to try and, in areas where they think it might be. This is, like, through a university, and Australia. And it was like, fuck yeah, man. We need that in America. Why can't, like, some enterprising university put up the money to try that in America? You know? I'd love to
see
it. So maybe if they get something good, although it's funny, then there was an article, like, a week later that was like, 1.6 odds of a thylacine still being alive is 1 in 1.6 billion or something like that. So it's like, talk about the ultimate underdog, but I'm pulling for it, and I hope it is still alive. And it's like, maybe, fingers crossed, maybe if they get something of interest with that, it will wake people up here in America who are, like, working at universities who will do that. Because you and I, dude, even though we're pretty well-known and pretty well-respected in this field, at least people don't think we're, like, jokers. It's like, if we put our money together and did something like that and strewn all these game cameras around, it wouldn't matter if we got, like, a crystal clear picture of Bigfoot. Like, no one would believe it. But if somebody from, you know, if somebody from some university somewhere in Oregon did it, then they would have the clout where it would actually mean something. As unfortunate as that sounds, that's the truth of the way the world works. So to bring it all around, it's like, thylacine thing, that's good. I'm glad they're doing it. I hope it works out and produces something of interest, which might light a fire here in America.
Well, I agree. And again, I'm pretty convinced that the thylacine is still out there. There's been some incredible footage that has been obtained over the years. There was one piece of very interesting footage that appeared to show an animal. This was obtained, I think, in 2012 around St. Clair, which was near an area called Lake Sapo. There was another piece of footage I, if memory serves, think appeared in 2015, which seems to show a creature very resemblant of the thylacine. Again, this creature had only gone extinct fairly recently, and there's very good film footage, you know, photographs and actual film of these, the last ones in captivity. And in fact, new photographs of one of the captive thylacines emerged just the other day, forgotten photographs other than new. But I see some of these videos. I mean, again, the behavior, the locomotion of the creatures in these films, I got to be honest with you, man, as you bring this up and we're talking about this, I mean, I almost get this kind of thrill. And you have to learn, I think, to kind of to pare back on that a little, because I think people do get a little emotional about this in the sense that they get excited and they want to believe and therefore they do believe. And I always try to temper that with a little cold, hard logic. But, man, I can't help but get a little excited when I watch these videos and I see what to me definitely looks like a good candidate. The video is clear enough and good enough that it seems to be a strong candidate for a creature like the so-called extinct thylacine. But then again, there are a lot of different other animals that are presumed extinct in which we still have sightings of them. The thylacine is by no means the only one. You know, there's the Eskimo curlew, which is a small northwestern shorebird, which has been believed to be extinct for decades. But there have been sightings in the 1980s as far south as Texas. I think there have been some more recent ones, too. No evidence whatsoever in the way of a specimen or of good video or photos that show that the curlew is still alive. But there have been qualified bird watchers and ornithologists who have said, that, yeah, we saw this thing, and it looked very much like the extinct curlew. So the problem, I think, is that, you know, when we talk about cryptozoology, people expect that they want to be able to say, hey, you know what? Bigfoot. Yeah, okay, cool. Mothman, you got it. Loch Ness Monster, hell yeah. Cryptozoology and the search for new animal species or those presumed extinct, which in fact may instead merely be critically endangered, doesn't have to really always be these so-called mythic, so-called monsters. It can involve a lot of different animal species, some of them fairly small and mundane by comparison, but that is no less a shocking discovery if indeed we continue to find animals that exist today, which were believed to have been extinct for some time. I'm hopeful that the thylacine is out there, and we often underestimate how wary animals can be, what degree of stealth in nature they can possess. And I remain hopeful, although I've certainly become more doubtful over time, but I still remain hopeful that there could be something to the Bigfoot and the Sasquatch legends. But I've had to ask more skeptical questions. Why don't we have better evidence for a creature like that? And if there is at least some good evidence, and I think that perhaps there at least is some worthy of consideration, the other question we have is, could it be that we are looking at the problem the wrong way? And people might say, what the hell is that supposed to mean? There's a big critter out there. We've got to find it. Well, are we dealing with a critter, or are we dealing with essentially what appears to be and resemble and perhaps behave like an archaic variety of early humans?
Right.
Maybe this thing is, again, similar enough to us that it would actually qualify as being some variety of the Homo species, but it is not quite human. I mean, there definitely are descriptions of these things that do seem to differ in terms of physical appearance and locomotion even. I mean,
well,
we hear the reports of...
I'm sorry, yeah. I'm agreeing with you because it was stands to reason in a sense because the North American continent was largely untouched for so long that it would give them time, it would give this species sort of time to put up roots and sort of like... I don't know, just they'd be a little bit ahead of the game. So I would give them the benefit of the doubt to that it's possible because the continent was so long untouched, and there's still parts of North America that haven't been explored necessarily, or at least are, you know, barren of human visitation.
Well, again, many would argue that there is no way that a creature like Bigfoot could possibly exist in a place populated as North America. But again, what I will also point out is that in the locations and the regions where the alleged sightings take place, again, you know, look at this as a pro argument if you like, but I don't really mean it as a pro or a con. I'm making the observation. Where people say that they see these things are among the most rugged and remote locations that still exist in North America. It's not like people claim,
exactly.
You know, yeah, on the outskirts of Chicago, we saw a Sasquatch. That would really make no sense. And those kinds of reports are not the ones that are forthcoming. And again, here's the thing I have to say, with all due respect to guys like Michael Shermer and other people in the skeptic community, and a lot of them who I, you know, have good relationships with. After what I saw on Joe Rogan today, and I can see that there can be, again, like my big issue with what Michael Shermer was talking about was that he didn't seem to understand that the Clovis first theory, the idea that the Clovis culture, which existed, you know, between, you know, 11,000, 12,000 years ago here in North America, the idea that they were the first to come to this country. He didn't seem to understand that that has long been disproven by the discoveries of archaeological evidence of earlier human settlements, earlier human habitation at sites like Meadowcroft Rock Shelter, one of the most extensively excavated sites in North America. He referred to Monte Verde, Chile, which is one of the very first confirmed pre-Clovis sites. He referred to that as being an anomaly. In other words, well, there, that seems to be something, but that one kind of stands out by itself. Absolutely wrong. Absolutely wrong in every way, shape, and form. I could go on mentioning confirmed pre-Clovis sites. Paige Ladson in Florida. You know, that one was underwater. They had to actually dive down underwater into a river, into a sinkhole, to be able to find a little shard of a lithic amidst some mastodon dung. But nonetheless, which they were able to get proper stratigraphic sequencing for, and they know absolutely is evidence of something that would have existed prior to what we identify as Clovis. So the point I'm making here is that Shermer was wrong. I'm not going to castigate him for that, but we recognize from experiences like this that, hey, a skeptic can be wrong too. So now let's look at Bigfoot. There's no way that a creature like that could exist, and you're crazy if you say that it could here in America. Well, you know what? It might be crazy to go around and say without any good evidence that Bigfoot absolutely exists. So I have to remain skeptical. But I'm going to challenge the skeptics just as well when they say, look, can't be, isn't, doesn't. No, actually, maybe we've been wrong before. Let's not step in that same intellectual black hole here and get sucked in. Let's leave enough room for possibility, but let's try and approach the problem differently.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Well, like I said, they can't say I don't know, so they have to speak in absolutes. It's like how you can't speak in absolutes about this stuff, man. It's still a giant question, you know. I will give them credit. I don't know what the right word is, but I mean, for a skeptic, they're in an untenable position anyway because they have to prove a negative. They have to have the impossible task of proving a negative in a sense where it's like they can't really ever necessarily prove these things don't exist. So they're in a tough position, but I don't think they handle being in that tough position very well either.
Well, actually, you know, I might differ with you there, Tim, in the sense that they're in a tough position. And with regard to the idea of proving negatives and whatnot, I actually find that there are many skeptics who they shy away from. And again, to his credit, Michael Shermer did a fine job in terms of being someone who would sit down and actually have a debate, but I don't think that he performed his very best. I think that Graham Hancock and Randall Carlson did a fine job showing how little Michael Shermer actually knew about the subjects that he was tasked with as representative skeptic with being skeptical of, and he didn't do as good a job. But I think that they all came away with more respect for each other, Shermer for Hancock and for Carlson, and I think each of them for Shermer. I really think that there was some progress made with that Joe Rogan interview. I mean, so little as a podcast, a celebrity podcaster sits down with a bunch of you know, guys and has them all sit down and have a powwow. Really, do we expect to move forward in our scientific thinking as a result of something like this? I think we did. And I really commend Joe Rogan for getting the three of them together and doing this fabulous four-hour podcast. See, that's the thing, though. Again,
4 hours, wow.
We have, yeah, it was lengthy, and a lot of it was it got to the brink of being rather boring, even though I think it was quite energizing. But there was quite a lot of heavy scientific discussion, especially in the latter 2 hours when they brought on a couple of geologists. And for me, I'm fascinated by that, but I was watching the live listenership numbers actually dwindling, and I have to say that, again, I realize that it's not something that is exciting and controversial always, and therefore it doesn't always grab our attention. But, you know, to see people having these in-depth discussions and debates, that's very inspiring, and I think that that was a real milestone that occurred today. But, again, you know, the broader point I really want to make here is I do often see that skeptics will say that their argument is rock solid, but really what I actually see them doing, let's be honest, they can go online. They won't do what Michael Shermer had the balls to do today and sit down and get into a good, heavy discussion. They will kick back and they'll write on their little blog, and they can always reference consensus opinions, and they can always reference again. And granted, that is generally good scientific data that they're referencing, but they're not really getting out there and getting involved in a debate, and they're not presenting their own research. They're attacking people who make claims that differ from those which fall in step with the view of the world that they have, the skeptics, and then they sit down on their blog and they go and they source, again, no actual research of their own. They source consensus material, and reliable though that may be, that's not really getting out there and, like Graham Hancock said, standing on the back of the Sphinx on the day of the spring equinox, you know, and watching the celestial alignment and whatnot. He, to his credit, whether or not you agree with guys like him, they do their own research, but many skeptical bloggers, they sit back. And not only do they just rely on whatever source material they can find at the bottom of the Wikipedia article and make it look like they're smart with a pre-planned statement that appears in a blog post rather than an actual real-time discussion, what they are actually doing is that, and they're being nasty about it because it gives them this ego boost to be able to be snarky and make other people look stupid. It makes them feel smarter. That kind of skepticism needs to end right now. This, we're going to be vitriolic, we're going to attack people, we're going to be mean, and we're going to, you know, kick back in our armchairs and write, you know, on our computers and make ourselves look smart so that we feel good at the end of the day. Guys, that's not good skepticism. Newsflash. We need more of like what we saw today with Joe Rogan and the guys. You know, we need more people who get in a real-time situation where their ideas and preconceptions are confronted, and sometimes harshly. And we have to all step back and realize we might not have known as much as we thought we did. Or as I saw today, Hancock and Carlson knew a lot more than they were given credit for by the skeptic community. But I mean, you apply that to Bigfoot.
Yeah, where are you disagreeing with me, though? Now I'm confused because I felt sympathy because they had to prove a negative. I still think they suck. Don't get me wrong, but it's a tough position to be in to try and have to prove a negative.
I don't think that they all suck, but the only way I disagreed with you was that where you had said that they had a hard job. I think that actually it's very easy for a skeptic to sit back, rely on consensus information.
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
See what I'm saying? That's very easy, and that's, to me, it's okay if they're relying on good data and they're going to say, guys, I'm sorry, but that's wrong, and here's why. That is fine. But when you pair that with what is obviously ego-driven, bitchy, snotty attitudes, and you're just picking on people and trying to make them look bad for pure folly and for pure sport, that's not good skepticism. That is all about your ego. I could name some skeptics who are like this who have come after me, but, you know, we don't have to get into all that, and I prefer not to because, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson has said this. I've heard a few other people say this. I think Carl Sagan, the late Sagan himself, had said it too. He said, for me, it's not about debates. I don't do these debates because as an educator, my job is not to debate. My job is to educate. If you watched the old Cosmos show that Sagan
I thought you said Bill Cosby. I was like, wow.
No.
How is he tying this in? Bill Cosby.
No, I said the Cosmos show that Sagan did, the original Cosmos. You know, Sagan had this wonderful, if not delightful, attitude. He was a skeptic about UFOs, but I mean, when he would talk about those subjects, there was never this, you're an idiot, you're wrong, this kind of vitriol. You know, you didn't see that from Sagan. He was always a gentleman. More vitriol from Stephen Hawking. You see more vitriol from Stephen Hawking, for God's sake, than you would see from from Carl Sagan. We need more guys like Sagan who write good skepticism, like The Demon-Haunted World, and who present good, well-rounded skeptical arguments without having to go out there and just be all about his ego. And I believe at some point I recall him even saying that that kind of attacking. That is just ego driven. And so, you know, again, to me, that's not a hard thing to do. And, you know, really, I mean, I'm sure that we do fundamentally agree here. But I was just trying to differ on that point that it's hard for them. No, some of those skeptics have very easy jobs, and what they do, I don't think is very admirable.
It's not that. Yeah, we're in agreement. We're probably just sort of like circling around on semantics. Yeah, these folks you're talking about, they're inherently lazy. So I think that's what it is. They're intellectually lazy, you know. So it's not a hard job. It's not hard to be intellectually lazy. Believe me, I'm intellectually lazy about a lot of things. So, so that's perfectly fine. I try not to be, but in some instances I am.
You know, I'll tell you where I've had to challenge myself in terms of intellectual fortitude more than any place else, Benal, is when it comes to the American political environment right now. You know, maybe we won't go
that's
down that rabbit
pivot.
Hole politics. Well, I do want to say.
Yeah.
I do want to say, I mean, like, well, we have talked about this, and I do know that you had wanted to discuss it a little bit. And so, I mean, I will just say that right now, my perception, I try to be a centrist. And that's why I do a podcast called Middle Theory essentially takes a centrist approach. And I've had people in the past say, you know, I wish that you kind of would, you know, have an opinion on things from time to time. Well, I mean, I always have an opinion on things, but I don't allow my opinion to fall lockstep with a party, a political party, or a political ideology. I try to look at things on a case-for-case basis. It's kind of like saying that if a person believes that there could be certain things that might qualify for being UFOs, that person automatically must also believe that giants once walked the earth, that Bigfoot is real, that elves and fairies are out there, and that they live under logs. You know, that's not a fair assessment to make. And when you begin to fall into a party politics kind of mode of thinking, I think that you once again fall into that potential trap of becoming essentially just that, somebody that, because my party says it, so I agree with everything that this politician or that this ideology or that this political platform holds to be true. I just don't agree with everything that the Democrats or the Republicans as a party say is and should be.
Right.
It's very interesting because right now with the media, man, I'm seeing both sides of the political fence pitching conspiracy theories, I mean, on an almost daily basis. It is unprecedented.
Right. That's what we were talking about before the show started. It's like both the hardcore people in both sides of the – in both parties are subscribed to conspiracy theories. It's an insane world right now. It's really hard to, like, coming from the conspiracy world, ironically enough, which is where we do, for better or for worse, you know, we swim in the conspiracy pool as a profession, as crazy as that sounds, as proud as my parents are of that accomplishment. As longtime residents of the conspiracy pool, it's like, what the fuck? Everybody's in the pool now, man. It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. And it's like you don't even know what's going on anymore. You don't know up is down, down is up. Alex Jones is like a global celebrity. He's like he's like an A-list celebrity in America, as crazy as that sounds. Absolutely mind-boggling, you know? And it's like, it's treacherous waters. I don't know how much you discuss this kind of stuff on your show. It's treacherous waters because the people, it is just like the real, you know, the conspiracy theories, you know, we cut our teeth on, you know, the 9/11 and the JFK. The people are just as crazy and adamant about these conspiracy theories that are reported on every night on the mainstream news, you know? I mean, I'm looking at the CNN right now, and it's like all they're talking about is this crazy week that Donald Trump has had, and it's all fueled by conspiracy, this conspiracy theory, the Russian conspiracy theory, essentially.
Well, I'll tell you something. Here's an interesting one that we can look at that I think gives us some perspective on things. I'm rather surprised to see that the controversial death of a Democratic National Committee staffer that occurred back during the 2016 election, Seth Rich, has been back in the news today. Now, I remember reporting on this when it happened and not thinking much of the story apart from what seemed to be a tragic mugging gone wrong, although I did ask at the time. This young man was found shot and killed. They were allegedly what was said was that it was an attempt to rob him, but when they found his body, they said it was a mugging gone wrong. He was shot and killed, but no one took any belongings from him. His wallet remained on his person when he was found. And so this was sent to me by one of my listeners, and we covered it on my podcast, and I remember thinking, okay, well, you know, that's an interesting story. Too bad that happened right here coinciding with the Democratic National Convention and all this, but, you know, I didn't really think about it as being anything deeper. Whispers start to come out that there had been potential evidence for contact between Rich and another individual, or possibly between Rich and actual WikiLeaks. The WikiLeaks organization, specifically Julian Assange, had specifically stated that he was looking for and offering a reward for information about the death of Seth Rich.
Right.
Of course, people have continued to ask, and I'm not trying to go off this whole, like, you know, because the Russia thing is, like you said, it's really become like the big news. We've had reports issued by the U.S. government that have shown some degree of Russian meddling, and it's not just been in America. We saw something similar leading up to the French election, so that is, I think, a factual narrative. Although there are some who tend to say that it's all made up, I really don't think that that's factual. I think that there's plenty of evidence that shows that Russia has been involved in things. But when we talk about, for instance, the Clinton email releases, you know, people have tried to say, and that probably is what happened. Russia did that. Well, Assange has denied that and says that no state-sponsored activities were behind what WikiLeaks obtained. But now here's what's interesting. Without trying to say this is or this is not what happened, I want to look at the different ways that spin is being applied to these recent headlines, because apparently Seth Rich is back in the news. A private investigator claims that there's not only evidence of it, but that he can prove essentially that, although right now this computer that belonged to Rich is in the possession of the FBI, he believes that there is evidence that Rich was directly in contact with WikiLeaks. But look at the different kinds of headlines. We've got right now, I think, a Washington Post reporting. I'm going to read the headline here for you. Family of slain Seth Rich says reports that he fed DNC info to WikiLeaks are untrue. Okay,
Washington Post reports. Those guys who bring that up, it's like, yeah, there's it's classic conspiracy theory shit here, man. It's crazy.
Now here's what's interesting. Washington Post, again, is saying that his family says that this whole thing about him feeding info to WikiLeaks, that's untrue. Now, that's the Washington Post, typically more liberal. I want to go over to, again, the most conservative of the conservative, Fox News. Let's see how they present the headline. Okay, same story. Headline reads, family of slain DNC staffer Seth Rich blasts detective over report of WikiLeaks link. So they're essentially talking about the same thing. The family disagrees with this detective. But let's go down here and see what the detective claims. He says, and I quote Rod Wheeler, okay, former District of Columbia homicide investigator, says, my investigation up to this point shows there was some degree of email exchange between Seth Rich and WikiLeaks. Okay? Even if tomorrow an email was found, it's not a high enough bar of evidence to prove any actions, as emails can be altered, and we've seen that those interested in pushing conspiracies will stop at nothing to do so. This is according to Brad Bowman, okay, one of his family members. Although
right.
Bowman and Wheeler... Bowman said Wheeler was paid by a third party. The family is named as clients of Wheeler's capital investigations on a contract signed by Rich's father, Joel Rich. Anyway, point I want to make here, though, is that the investigator, okay, who's involved with this, and I want to go back to another quote here, okay. I have seen and read the emails between Seth Rich and WikiLeaks, the federal investigator told Fox News, confirming the McFadden connection. McFadden, again, being Gavin McFadden, a now-deceased American investigative reporter who allegedly was kind of a go-between. But he says, I mean, I have seen and read the emails between Seth Rich and WikiLeaks. My investigation up to this point shows there was some degree of email exchange between Seth Rich and WikiLeaks. I do believe that the answers to who murdered him sits on his computer on a shelf at the D.C. police or at the FBI headquarters. So how do we interpret this? Because, again, the right is looking at the same story and saying, well, the investigators are saying that, yeah, they've seen evidence that there were emails between the two. And then the liberal media reports that, well, his family says that those reports are untrue. Both side points at the other and says what you're saying is a conspiracy theory. What are the actual facts? You know, what are the actual facts? And maybe that's yet to be completely determined. I mean, maybe we'll have to see more in the coming days. And I realize that based on people's, again, political biases, that they will hear what I have said and they will look at either side of that narrative and they will find the one that suits their preconceptions. And they will say that if you agree with the alternative, you're crazy. All I want to know is the truth, but what I do see on an almost daily basis, and you can apply that to Donald Trump in his first 100 days in the office, you can apply that to whatever, you know, Bernie Sanders. I mean, there are any number of different individuals and a lot of different narratives that we could look at, and we could say, you know, is there some sort of an element of conspiracy? And I see both the right and the left kind of pushing those these days, which to me is a really unusual phenomena. What does it say? Does it say that there's just a lot more general unrest in our country right now? Does it say things about the way that media is changing and the way that our journalists are writing it? I don't know.
The limits of debate in this country are established before the debate even begins, and everyone else is marginalized. They're made to seem either to be communists or some sort of disloyal person. A kook, there's a word.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
And now it's conspiracy. See, they've made that something that should not be even entertained for a minute, that powerful people might get together and have a plan. Doesn't happen. You're a kook. You're a conspiracy buff.